Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. Many of us know what to do if we see someone clutching their chest, pass out, or find ourselves on the scene of a car crash. Thanks to the efforts of the Red Cross and others, millions of people have been trained in first aid and CPR and are able to lend aid in a medical crisis. There is, however, another type of emergent situation that most people have no idea how to intervene with or even recognize. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, one in five adults in the U.S. experiences a mental illness in a given year. Perhaps the most important element for success in treating mental illness is early detection and intervention. All too often, those in need aren't provided services until it's too late. Well, the good news is that a relatively new approach to intervening in a mental health crisis has arrived. Mental health first aid training introduces participants to the risk factors and warning signs of mental health problems, shares information about common treatments, helps to reduce the stigma and fear about mental health, and most importantly, provides tips for how to recognize and intervene in a mental health crisis. Joining me to discuss mental health first aid is Alaska's statewide coordinator for the implementation of mental health first aid, Jill Ramsey. Ms. Ramsey is the behavioral health training coordinator and an adjunct professor at the Center for Human Development at the University of Alaska Anchorage. She holds an MS degree in psychiatric rehabilitation from Rutgers University and has worked in the mental health field for 26 years. Originally from New Mexico, Ms. Ramsey has lived and worked in Alaska for the past 16 years. She has education and experience in health services management, as well as direct service experience with adults experiencing serious mental illness, substance abuse disorders, developmental disabilities, and homelessness. Ms. Ramsey is a nationally certified instructor of mental health first aid, nonviolent physical crisis intervention, and is a master trainer in QPR suicide prevention. I really appreciate you taking the time to join me today, Jill.
Thank you. I'm grateful for your interest.
What is QPR suicide?
That's a best practice suicide prevention model. It stands for question, persuade, refer.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that for listeners. I need to take a moment, just a second here, to remind our listeners how we can be reached with your questions or comments. You can call us locally at 550-8433, or on our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And you can always email us your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. If this is your first time emailing us, you got to spell out line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E. All right, so let's start off, I guess, with describe it's something, mental health first aid. I think you guys reached out to me last year about this, or no, I guess it was, anyway, about a year ago or so, and mental health first aid. And it's something I hadn't heard of. As a therapist, and I've worked in mental health field for a long time now, 30 years, I guess. I hadn't heard of it, and so can you describe for our audience, because I think it's relatively new, what is mental health first aid?
Sure, and it is relatively new. When you consider how long CPR and standard first aid have been around, it's relatively new. It is an 8-hour certification course that teaches people how to recognize the symptoms of a mental health crisis as the crisis is unfolding, and some real action steps around how we would address that effective intervention in a developing mental health crisis or substance abuse crisis. The name doesn't indicate it, but we do talk about substance abuse crisis and apply action steps to a developing crisis around substances as well.
Okay, so it's my understanding is it's new to Alaska, really, within the last 5 years. Can you give us a little bit of history on how this movement started, where it started, and why it got going?
The course was developed in Australia in 2001 by a nurse, actually. Betty Kitchener is a nurse who, as a young person, experienced depression, actually had a pretty serious suicide attempt as a teenager. She went on to nursing school, became an RN, became a CPR instructor, was actually a health educator, and married a behavioral health researcher who's a mental health literacy professor. And the two of them developed this curriculum based on this idea that we have this baseline level of knowledge in the community in responding to a broken arm or someone choking, but we really don't have anything to help us identify mental health crises and what we would do about it. So they really looked at and explored all of the barriers to that. Why don't we? So there's a big part of that curriculum that addresses what do we know about mental health issues? What's the stigma around that? What's the barriers to our getting involved? Why is it that we wouldn't hesitate to try and help someone who was choking in a restaurant next to us? Whether or not we've ever even had that training, we would probably get up and do something. But someone who's suicidal or someone who's having a panic attack or someone who's hearing voices, we will tend to be afraid of and not intervene, or we'll just call the police. We wouldn't even think to try to do something as a neighbor or a stranger.
Well, we'll get into a little bit more of what to do later on. So can you tell us a little bit about what your role is as I mentioned on the intro, the statewide coordinator for mental health training. What is your role? What is your activity at UAA? How are you guys involved over there?
Well, we're part of the Center for Human Development is part of the College of Health. And within that, we have a workforce development initiative. It's a training co-op intended to address workforce development training gaps in the healthcare realm. So I am the behavioral health training coordinator. So the behavioral health trainings tend to come to me. And when I started the position, they had just made the decision to bring mental health first aid into the training cooperative and have us start to deliver this training statewide. So that became my job. Among other things, that became my primary focus over the last 4.5 years was to develop more trainers and really get this training out there and saturate communities with this, you know, increase the level of knowledge around mental health crises.
Okay, now this is not something that we've really touched on in our preparation, but I noticed there's a lot of stuff around a lot of hits when I searched mental health first aid on the legislature and Obama putting some stuff together, and then we had some representatives here locally in the last few years that have pushed some legislation. Can you talk a little bit about that? I know I didn't have you prepare for that, but do you?
Well, there's been a lot of attention drawn to the fact that we have such a provider shortage, and we have such a need for resources that we don't necessarily have nationally. And so there's been a big push for more federal dollars to support mental health systems. Locally, we did have some interest in a state bill at one point to bring youth mental health first aid curriculums to Alaska. We didn't have that. But since that time, there's been a part of that ultimate federal legislation led to a SAMHSA award, which was the AWARE project. That the origins of that is part of that federal legislation that actually trickled down to Alaska. We did apply. We did receive that. So now we have the Youth Mental Health First Aid Initiative that's happening, and we've trained 1,000 people in a year with that project. So it's really taken off in the school districts. Now that's intended to help in particular targeted regions of our state where there are alternative high schools and school district projects centering around mental health resources for teenagers.
All right. Well, let's we'll kind of jump ahead, and since you brought up teenagers, and I want to read something that was sent into a question from one of our listeners. It says, Mr. Pemberton, I recently took the mental health first aid course and would like to tell you how much I enjoyed it and learned from it. It is an excellent course and teaches people how to help others who are dealing with depression, anxiety, or suicidal ideation. The course is offered free to anyone who wants to take it. Now, you mentioned it's free to teenagers or...
No, that course is free to anyone, and it's not intended for teenagers. It's intended for adults working with youth, and it's because of that federal legislation that led to a state grant that we were able to implement that for free.
Okay, the Anchorage School District has its very own teacher, school nurse Susan Whitted. Susie was my instructor, and my class had several school nurses in attendance. Those school nurses have helped kids with mental health issues in their own schools, and we all felt the class was very well worth our time. We all agreed it would be a great class for anyone interested in mental health, just as a regular first aid class helps a person be more prepared and confident giving first aid. So can you tell us what the school district is doing? This letter is from a teacher, Luann Fogles. She is she's not a teacher, she's a nurse at the school. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on in the schools and what the difference is? Is there a class geared directly for adolescents?
There is. There's actually several different versions of mental health first aid, and we can talk about the differences there. The youth mental health first aid training is part of a larger project that's focusing resources on Mat-Su, Anchorage, and Kenai school districts. And our part of that, implementing the youth mental health first aid, is to have instructors of that course in the schools, in the school districts, and really saturate those communities with the same information so that our first responders, our teachers, our school nurses, all of our school staff, from maintenance to principal, have this training, and that we're all on the same page, and that we are emphasizing the need for a structured referral system and to really do that next level of handoff. 'Cause it's, you know, the course is designed to help you recognize a mental health problem, but it's also designed to help you learn what the resources are so that you can be that bridge, so that you can recommend appropriate professional help for somebody who needs that. None of these courses are suggesting that people become mental health professionals.
Right.
It's really first aid. It really is. It's just like standard first aid in that we're not asking people to diagnose other people. We're not training people to do therapy or support groups. We're really teaching first aid. Here are the symptoms, here are the signs, and here is an action plan that you can apply to help somebody get to a better place. Maybe you're stabilizing the crisis, or better yet, maybe you're resolving the crisis. Not everything has to rise to a level of a 911 call, for instance.
Right.
Or, you know, if our communities have a baseline level of knowledge about some of these issues, many of them can resolve without emergency services involved, without force, without some of the more intense and expensive sorts of interventions.
Okay, now one of the important components in this is a concept called mental health literacy. Can you speak a little bit to what mental health literacy means and why that's so important?
What we mean by that is we've normalized this way of speaking about people with mental health problems that's really pretty unacceptable. And we do it sort of unknowingly. I don't think most people are malicious about it. I think that we've, as a society, we've really somehow it's become acceptable language. Whether we get our information from Hollywood or Netflix or the media, we are using terminology that's actually very damaging, very hurtful, and very stigmatizing for people. And so we really draw that out in the course. Let's look at how language affects the way that we think about people, the way that we treat other people. And we actually have people explore that. What are some terms that you use when what you mean to say is somebody with a mental health problem, but we're saying crazy, or we're saying nuts, or we're saying whatever? And we actually draw that out, and we have people look at that. How is your language conveying what you believe about other people? And then how do we change that? How do we speak appropriately then about mental health issues and sort of get through that? I actually asked people, if we were to do that same exercise with racial slurs,
right,
how long would you tolerate that conversation? Would that be a comfortable space? No. The people sweat with my suggestion of that. But it's really not any different. The exercise is the same. It's intended to help us develop ways to talk about mental health safely, appropriately, and respectfully. and to help people understand that these are not character flaws. These are not, this is not the result of bad parenting. This is not a willpower sort of issue that people are facing. And we need to be able to talk about it. It needs to be a safe, for some people, this is this the only place that they've ever had a safe conversation about their own mental health or what's going on with their family. So we draw that out. We help people sort of practice how you do appropriately talk about mental health issues. I ask people, how would you explain schizophrenia to a 10-year-old? What would you say? And so we actually walk through that, because you wouldn't say, well, that person's a nut job, right?
Right.
We would say, this is somebody with a brain disorder whose, you know, brain's malfunctioning and makes, you know, makes him maybe behave differently than you or I might do. So it's a conversation about stigma, which we're, you know, we're being told now on the national level that that's really not a PC word anymore either. Stigma is stigmatizing.
Stigma's out.
It is. Stigma's out. What we're really talking about is prejudice and discrimination. So we need to call it what it is. And that's the number one barrier for people getting help. What will my neighbors think? What will my employer think? What will my spouse think? What will my friends think? Because of the way that we have perpetuated and normalized this sort of derogatory marginalizing of these, what are actually brain disorders.
All right. I need to just take a second to remind those who might be tuning in late that my guest today is the behavioral health training coordinator for the University of Alaska, Jill Ramsey. Our topic today is mental health first aid. You can reach us with your questions or comments at our local phone number, 550-8433. Call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email any questions or comments at our email, line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, I would like to, we're going to go to the phones now. We have Brenda, you're on the air. Hello, Brenda.
Hi.
Hey, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if you're going to take that program out to the bush communities, not just the road system, because we sure need it out here. And I'll hang up and listen to your answer on the radio. Thanks for taking my call. Bye.
Thank you, Brenda. I appreciate the call. Go ahead, Jill.
Thank you, Brenda. Thanks for asking. We've actually delivered this course in 30 separate communities in Alaska over the last 4.5 years. So we have been in numerous bush communities. What we don't do is show up places we're not invited. So all one must do is contact us through the Alaska Training Cooperative and request a training, and we can make that happen. We've done that in many, many places in Alaska.
Jill, can you go ahead and give out that information now? I'm going to add it to the website, but we don't have that on the show site right now. How can people, if they want to request a training, and I think that's good practice to not go where unless you've been invited. But
exactly.
What is the website? How can people find that information?
You can find me. You can call me to set up training at 907-264-2668 or email me jill@alaskachd.org. To find trainings that are currently scheduled, and we have a number of them up in Juneau, Fairbanks, and Anchorage, Valdez right now that are open for registration at akttclms.org. You can see that schedule. It also has on there all the youth mental health first aid trainings that have been scheduled that are open for registration right now. But you can contact me if there's a community that's not posted up there that you're interested in. We certainly do go wherever we are invited.
Okay, great. I do have your contact information already available on the web, along with lots of great resources for mental health first aid and the national website and tons of really good information and reading about mental health first aid, why it's important, all the stuff you're trying to to introduce folks to here. I want to get back real quick to one of the things that's really important for me, and one of the reasons I really had you on and why I do this radio show, is that stigma that you mentioned of mental health. Words like nut job, crazy, wacko, those things are really damaging to people. And I think it's interesting since, you know, in the intro, I did mention that 1 in 5 Americans will experience a mental health problem this year alone. And over the course of our lifetime, there's not any of us who are not touched personally by somebody in our family, be it substance abuse, be it depression, be it anxiety. I would challenge anybody to call in whose family and friends are mental health free. Right. So to change this dialogue, much like people, you know, used to be referred to as cripple or, you know, people in wheelchairs and people with developmental disabilities, changing that language and that dialogue is so important. So I appreciate that. And I think that is important for the teenagers. And that's why it's so impressive that you guys are doing this with adolescents in the schools. So thanks for doing that and bringing that up. So why is it so important in Alaska? I think our last caller touched on it. The rural communities, she mentioned that's really important out here. So why is Alaska so ripe for this, and why do we need this everywhere?
That I could spend an hour probably on just that. But one of the things is what you mentioned is the prevalence data. What we know about the prevalence data in Alaska, there was just a completed behavioral health assessment that showed us 28% of Alaskans have a diagnosable mental health condition and or substance abuse disorder or both. So the prevalence alone and our suicide rate alone would be reason enough. But really, in Alaska, we have a very self-reliant sort of community of pioneers, and I think it fits really nicely in the way that we think about what kind of community do we want to live in. We want to live in a community where people will help each other, people care. Providing some skills behind that's a great idea, but I think that we are compassionate people. There are also always going to be a shortage of resources and providers in this state. We train behavioral health aides out in villages that may be the only person there. They may be the only healthcare provider in the whole village. There may be one police officer and one health aide, and we train them both. So it's, when you think about the lack of resources, how important would it be for individuals to know what to do themselves? And that's really what we talk about in very small communities and large ones as well. It's not just who do you refer the person to, but what do you do in those moments, in those hours, days, weeks, sometimes that a mental health crisis is unfolding in your community? What do you do individually in those situations? How can you best manage that and leave a situation knowing that you've done everything reasonable that you could do and have some resources and information to back that up? That's really what the course provides. People are getting confident enough to do something where they wouldn't have before, and really learning about mental health. One of the secondary effects that we're seeing from the course is people's own mental health is improving. They're starting to look at, they think they're going to the course so they can help other people, and it turns out they start to self-reflect and say, well, maybe I am drinking too much. Maybe I should get help for this depression that I've had for 10 years and never really sought any help for. And so we're seeing some of that in the research data come through as well.
Or they say, oh, that's what depression is.
Right.
Oh,
right.
That's anxiety.
Oh, my gosh.
That's the thing I'm feeling.
Right.
Right. You just came back from Bethel? Is that, or where were you doing a training or something?
No, I was actually in Craig. It was Prince of Wales Island.
Okay, small town. And what's that experience like? How are you received? What kind of welcome and information are you sharing? And what are people saying in those smaller communities?
They asked us there, and they were very welcoming and seemed to really need the information. Those small communities actually in some ways are far ahead of Anchorage and some other places in terms of sort of breaking down that stigma. When there's one clinic in a community where you may be going there because you have the flu, or you may be going there because you have depression, and nobody really knows why your car is outside of the clinic,
right?
Then we have we've broken down some stigma there. But those communities are, they're really looking at how to take care of one another in a place where there aren't very many resources. They can't just call a crisis team to come running out and help them with some sort of issue. They really need to be individually equipped. We also had four EMTs in that training from Craig that were there as first responders, and the evaluations for them were absolutely really inspiring. It's a little frustrating. Some of the feedback we get is, I wish we'd had this 10 years ago.
Right.
You know, why didn't we have this 10 years ago? And I can't answer that. But what we do now is help people really put a context to an action plan in mental health first aid, whether you're a first responder or a teacher or a landlord. How these skills are useful, and people are telling us that they are, we get testimonials all the time from folks saying, I used it and I recognized something I wouldn't have recognized before.
You mentioned first responders. I know as a, standard course of action, every first responder, every police officer, fire department, personnel, they all have first aid, CPR, all that, teachers and all that. Is that becoming the standard here with mental health first aid? What are you getting when you, are you showing up at the fire department? Are you showing up at the police department, APD, doing this training? And is it becoming more common?
It is. We have a mental health first aid curriculum that is for public safety law enforcement corrections, and it's tailored for them. It gives a little bit different context to the interventions they would have. But we've been, and corporate's taken us years, but we are now part of the Anchorage Police Academy trainings with mental health first aid. We have other communities that have really embraced mental health first aid. The Matsu Valley has formed a coalition of first responders. But with the wisdom that it needs to be, part of the real value of doing that training, apart from the skills you learn and the resources you learn, is to have a less homogenized group of people that network. So we have the mental health courts, people participating with the behavioral health, people who are participating with the law enforcement and the troopers, and together they are actually in the same room getting the same information about how to deal with a mental health crisis, and then what the referral points are, what the resources are, and how you access them. So we could go all day on the resources we don't have. That conversation always happens. But what's really been valuable in those trainings is that people are learning who to call. The individual relationships that are formed make the difference in a place where the gaps are so huge that they're actually mitigating that by having a business card of somebody that they took a training with that they can call up and say, I need to, this person needs to be in mental health court, this person needs an evaluation at the ER, or this person needs whatever. And so they're able to network with each other, and it's very, very valuable. That course, our corrections folks, our police officers and troopers and first responders are telling us that as much as 50% of their calls involve somebody with a mental health crisis or substance abuse crisis or both.
Right.
And so it's become a very popular course for first responders, particularly police officers, who are looking for resources, but they're also looking for ways to de-escalate situations that don't have to result in some sort of use of force.
I have a couple more questions on that when we come back. But right now, we're at the halfway point in our show, so we're just going to take just a real short break and remind people that you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. My guest today is the Behavioral Health Training Coordinator for the University of Alaska, Jill Ramsey. Our topic today is mental health first aid. You can reach us at 550-8433. Call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email your questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation about mental health first aid. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line 1, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Behavioral Health Training Coordinator for the University of Alaska, Jill Ramsey. Our topic today is mental health first aid, how to recognize and intervene in a mental health crisis. As always, you can email your questions or comments about today's show to line1@alaskapublic.org, and we'll read those on the air if you get them to us. You can call us locally at 550-8433 or call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember the show repeats tonight at 8, so if you're listening to this on Monday evening, you'll be hearing a taped recording and we will not be accepting phone calls. A lot of times I get calls in right at about 6 minutes till the hour, and that's really difficult. So if you do have a question for Jill, about training or what they cover or mental health in general, please feel free to give us a call here in the next 15 or so minutes and not right up against the hour. Okay, before we left, we were talking a little bit about first responders, and you mentioned the word corrections, and I want to bring that up. It's not something I really even thought about, but it's an obvious question because our prisons and LA County Prison has been described as the largest mental health facility in the world. Our correctional officers, and my father was a psychologist on death row in Georgia for many years, and worked primarily, he did see the inmates, but he worked primarily with the correctional officers, learning to treat people with compassion and as human beings despite their crimes, to sort of separate the people from the crime, which was a very powerful experience for him. And he saw violence go down, both inmate on inmate and inmate on guards, after he had really worked with the correctional officers. So have you guys been invited into the prisons? Are you working with the correctional staff in our prisons here in the state? And are they doing that outside?
We are here in Alaska. We are starting to do that. They are part of that continuum of first responder that's been asking for this training. Probably less so than some of the others, but as we start thinking about criminal justice reform, we start thinking about reentry. Yeah. We certainly are getting a lot of response from all sorts of staff within corrections. And I think it's important to sort of separate that out. Part of understanding the parity really with some other health problems and public health problems is separating out this idea that people with mental health issues are criminals and they're all violent. So we tread very lightly on making those associations. However, it's a really unique environment for people to deal with mental health issues in the prison system, because that's a place of quote-unquote punishment. And so some of the ways that we've seen that expressed were actually very inhumane in terms of withholding somebody's medication because we you know, we don't want them to be rewarded by feeling good. And, you know, we really have to go in there and talk about ADA, how the Americans with Disabilities Act actually applies in the prisons. Like, people still are entitled to health care of all kinds, including mental health care in the prisons. And but really, the corrections officers are looking for ways to de-escalate behavior, ways to maybe mitigate a developing mental health crisis that somebody may have, or deal with suicidality.
It seems like it's, I mean, in the news recently, we've had some, we had a situation where somebody was killed in the prisons, and there was a, I mean, they were described as vulnerable adults or adults who had a history of mental health problems. And it seems like it's really, really important for us to be able to identify those things. And obviously, it's, I guess it's not the correctional officer's job to identify that. It should be done way ahead. But to be able to recognize those folks and take extra measures to for the vulnerable, because people with mental health issues and substance abuse disorders are a vulnerable population.
Yes.
Oftentimes, head injuries.
Can be, yeah. Yes. And well, in terms of violence, though, 11 times more likely to be the victim of violent crime than the perpetrator of violent crime. Hmm. So unfortunately, we zero in the media on somebody who was violent and has a mental health issue, when really that's not the statistic. That's really not.
That's the minority.
That's the minority. Absolutely. So it's, you know, it's interesting. There's been so much in the news, really, needs for training for police officers to recognize autism, recognize behaviors that might look like deception or defiance that really may be a mental health issue, maybe a brain disorder. That's part of the curriculum in mental health first aid for first responders, is are things like that. What would you notice around somebody with autism, and how might you approach them differently?
Yeah. Okay, and also I assume recognizing the difference between diabetes and, you know, a diabetic sort of event versus a mental health problem can be tricky sometimes, but there's differences. So are they learning recognition of and symptoms and how to identify it versus regular criminal behavior?
Sort of. The heart of the course is about what are the risks presented associated with depression. Well, that might be self-injury, it might be suicide. What are the risks? What would you likely see around anxiety? Well, people may have a panic attack. How do you help somebody through a panic attack? It's a whole lot less about labels and diagnoses. That's really kind of none of our business in terms of first aid. It's more, what are the symptoms and what do we do about them in the moment? And it really kind of, the cause is less of the issue than what is the risk there.
So much like if I go in and I see somebody down and I go and provide CPR, I'm not worried about a diagnosis necessarily, because I don't know. And I just know there's something obstructing an airway or...
Right. Yeah. So just as we wouldn't ask somebody with CPR training to do heart surgery, or somebody with standard first aid training to do long-term follow-up care, it really is first aid. It's about recognizing what's before you and what is the best thing that I can do to help that person in that moment.
Okay, I have another email, and I'm not sure. Maybe you'll recognize what this is. It says, as evidence-based practice, have there been evidence of overreach by the public not following the hands-off practice? In a small town, patient privacy can be hard to keep. Hmm. Do you know what that... I mean, I didn't know if you would recognize
I think so. It. There's a couple of issues that I hear in that. One of the secondary effects that we're noticing from the course, one of which I mentioned, was people's own mental health is improving because they're sort of recognizing some... doing some self-reflecting. The other thing that we didn't anticipate happening, we were having testimony around people telling us that they were over-involved in somebody's mental health issue before. Mm-hmm. This course gave them a framework to actually contain their intervention, some things to think about and some boundaries around, you know, what's helpful. one person wrote to us and said, you know, if I hadn't had the course, I would have inserted myself way too much into somebody's ability to solve their own problem. So we have some of that going on. Now, this sounds like, you know, we talk a lot about how small a place we're in when we do these courses, because we really want people to make it relevant to them. We want them to ask every question that they have. And the worst thing for us as trainers is to leave a course with people saying, I still don't know what to do about so-and-so, or whatever they're dealing with. So we want people to ask questions that are about things that are really happening. And it doesn't take too long in a small community for everybody to figure out who they're talking about, if that's the case. So we make an agreement about confidentiality and safety so that we can have these conversations and that it's relevant. We're not going to do scenarios that don't apply to individual communities. And so I'm not sure that that gets at what this person is asking. We haven't found that people are over-involved because of the course. We're actually kind of finding the opposite. The people are finding a structure with which to work in to deal with the crisis that they recognize. Before, it seemed like an obstacle to get people involved. Like there's a reluctancy to get involved. That's family business, or that's, you know, that's not my area. I'm going to call the mental health professional. And so breaking through that was like the initial goal. And now we're learning that it's actually got, that conversation has two ends to it. It's containing things with appropriate boundaries and appropriate involvement. And also breaking down the barriers and increasing confidence in getting involved in the first place. So I'm not seeing the problems, at least not the way that this person described it in their question.
Okay, if you're joining us late, my guest today is the Behavioral Health Training Coordinator for the University of Alaska Anchorage, Jill Ramsey. Our topic today is mental health first aid. As always, you can call us with your questions or comments at 550-8433 or toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to participate is by emailing your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, the nuts and bolts of this. Can you talk a little bit about the five-step action plan or the, I guess it's ALGI, in a mental health crisis? Like, what is that? Can you break that down for us?
Well, ALGI is our acronym, like you would learn in standard first aid or CPR. I think it was ABCs, and then it was CABs, and we're not
Changes
sure where
a
we
lot.
Are.
Yeah.
ALGI is just odd enough that you might remember it, but the action plan is based on these five things, which are not linear. Nothing really happens in a linear way, but it's a way to remember things and call them up quickly in a crisis. The A is about assessing for risk of suicide or harm. So when you're in a situation, you want to be thinking about what's the risk of harm. What is? How do we figure out how much trouble this person is in? And that might inform a few other steps. The L is about listening, and it's listening without judgment. So it's in there. It sounds like a no-brainer, but it really is a skill that we have to be aware of in order to even do. Listening non-judgmentally is very, very difficult. And, you know, the word judgment has a very negative connotation, but it really just means that we come packed with our own experiences, our own political beliefs, our own spirituality, our own preconceived notions about that person or what they're dealing with. And if we're not able to set that aside, we're not going to be very effective first aiders.
In social work, we call that unconditional positive regard, which is really about seeing the person as a person. And I mean, listening is one of the most powerful tools that we have for somebody who is struggling. Oftentimes, that's really the thing they need to do is to talk.
Right, right. And unless somebody has come to me and said, Jill, I want you to solve my problem, my job is to listen. It's just to receive. That's all. And we have a hard time as human beings doing that. I'm just packed with advice. I'm just dying to give you about all the things that you just said because I know so much about it, right?
Yeah. But
sometimes people just need to tell their story. And if you can hear it, you can receive it. Sometimes the crisis resolves in just that act. So we work on that in the action plan and what that means to do. And the G is about giving reassurance and information. So it might be the hope that you give somebody in a situation where you're the only person in their whole day that says, you're okay, you're going to be all right, you can get through this. This is, you know, you might normalize things for people. You might say something like it's very common to have suicidal thoughts when you've been depressed this long or you're grieving.
Right.
You don't have to act on those. So you might be the agent of hope. You might be, but you back that up with the information that you know. Here's what I know about what you're telling me, and here's some resources that can help you. And I'll go with you. You know, sometimes it's not about saying all the right things. It's about being there. It's about being a presence that cares. And then the two E's are really about encouraging professional help where that's warranted and knowing what those resources are. So each and every course in every community we train in, we come ready with all of the resources of that area so that we're not just telling people to encourage professional help, but we know what they are and we know how to access them and that people learn that. And then the second E is about the non-professional help, the encouraging self-help and support. Maybe it's nutrition, maybe it's exercise, maybe it's yoga, maybe it's some of the things that the person has done in the past that worked for them before. Maybe it's reminding them, or maybe it's the supportive people in their life. Maybe it's their faith-based. Maybe it's, I've had people tell me it's my grandmother I want beside me if something's really going down. I really, it's whatever is supportive to that person and exploring that with people and helping them to cultivate that. So together, all of those things, really we practice, just like you practice in standard first aid. We have people actually role play and practice how they would start a conversation with somebody that they're concerned about, maybe somebody that's been depressed for a long time and they're concerned about them, or we role play panic attacks. You know, what do you do? Somebody is, you're in an elevator with somebody who's having a panic attack. I'm always on an airplane next to somebody who seems to be having a panic attack. I practice this quite frequently because it's very, very common. You are 10 times more likely to encounter somebody having a panic attack than you are a heart attack. So it makes some sense to have mental health first aid.
All right, let's take just a quick second to go to the phones. We have Janet, you're on the air with Jill Ramsey. Hello, Janet.
Yeah, hello, thank you. This question is about who to call if you have what is obvious an independent living situation for people who have mental health in your neighborhood, which we do. You mentioned about calling the police and making sure that they would be that they would know to handle the situation carefully and properly. So my question is, if there were to be something that would happen on our street with the people living there, either perhaps doing harm to themselves or somebody else, if I were to call the police, do the police know just by the address the situation of the people there?
Not necessarily. And are you in Anchorage?
Yes.
What police officers in Anchorage have a course called Crisis Intervention Team. They're CIT officers that go through a 40-hour training, very intensive training, specifically for responding to psychiatric crises. And so while we're very good at talking about CIT, sometimes we're not informing the community that those CIT officers are there and that you need to ask for one. So if you are seeing something that warrants calling 911 related to a psychiatric crisis, make sure that you ask for a CIT officer. Let them know that it's something of a psychiatric emergency and that you'd like somebody with some expertise in that. Now, ideally, we'd love that all officers have that level of training, and we're working on that. And certainly we're getting mental health first aid to all officers. But that 40-hour specialized training is much more in-depth, and not everybody knows to ask for that.
I see. Well, that would be helpful because I've often wondered over the years who to call. There's a mental health institution that places these people in these independent living. I wouldn't know who to call. Is there such a thing? If there are independent living houses where there are people with mental and or physical health problems, is there an umbrella organization that places these people? Other than then calling the police, would there be somebody else to call?
All right, Janet, I appreciate the call. Thanks. Let me take a stab at that. I ran a assisted living home, which is what you're speaking of, I believe, an assisted living home for adults with mental health and developmental disabilities. And one of the things that I did, there are several organizations within the community, Hope Cottages, Assets, ARC, you know, of Anchorage. I think there's quite a few of them that license and place adults and children into the homes. And it's a great resource. I mean, community living, independent living, maximizing independence. And so fortunately for you, you're lucky enough to have one of those in your neighborhood. I mean, there's some really great folks working with these individuals, and they know how to handle these situations. So, but I do think if you see somebody who's acting dangerously, is to notify the police and to let them know that you have, you know, an assisted living home in your community, and you think it might be one of these individuals, because there have been situations in which officers came into a situation and they didn't know that it was somebody with severe autism or Asperger's or some other situation. So it's important to notify and give, just like you would in any other crisis situation, good information, accurate information. Let them know the situation, what you see, what you know. But 911 is an appropriate phone call if you see an emergency crisis, and to let them know what's going on as much as possible. I mean, I would always call. I had to call quite a few times on my own, you know, residence, and I would say, this is an assisted living home. This is a young man who experiences emotional difficulties, and please come in, you know, quietly and cautiously, and I need some assistance. So thank you very much for the call. That was a really good question. Okay. Before we wrap up here, I'd like for you to talk a little bit about the ideas of recovery and resiliency and how these apply to mental health. One of the great things about what we're doing here today is to reduce some of this stigma and normalize it, I hope, for folks. Can you talk a little bit about recovery and resiliency? Those are two words that keep popping up.
I can, and I'm so glad you asked. Part of the course, whether it's the adult course or the youth curriculum, we talk about recovery and we talk about resiliency. I throw out in every course, I ask people, can people recover from mental illness? And then they'll say, well, you know, what depends on what it is. And I'll say, well, can people recover from schizophrenia? And about half the class says, absolutely not, no way. And about half the class says, well, it depends on your definition of recovery. And really, that is a fine point. That's borrowed terminology from addictions field, which means you always have the thing, but maybe you manage the thing. But really, what we know is that people can recover. People can have a full remission of symptoms with schizophrenia, bipolar, PTSD, anything you can think of, in the same ways that physical illnesses can have full remission of symptoms. So people do recover, and that is a very, very important thing that people hear for the first time sometimes in mental health first aid. And we talk about why that is. Why do you have this idea that people can't recover? We don't see a lot of that. That's not sexy news when somebody with schizophrenia gets a job and recovers their life. We don't see that on the headlines. But that happens. The other reason you don't know that is because if I am somebody who's recovered from schizophrenia, I'm probably not going to tell you that. Probably want to be as far away from the mental health system and labels like that as I possibly can get. So we don't get the benefit of knowing all of the people who actually have recovered from some very major mental illness, unless they want to be a peer support specialist or they want to be the poster child. You don't get that story. I get them after class time and time again. People don't hesitate to tell me their story in private. But you don't always get to know how prevalent it is that people can recover from anything with enough of the right supports. And that's something that we stress in class and people learn for the first time. Resiliency is one of those things. I mean, people are thought of as vulnerable. They're thought of as fragile. And really, these are some of the most resilient people you'll ever meet, people who are dealing with some very difficult things day in, day out. Also, the resiliency of our youth. The youth curriculum is very good at really looking at what is normal adolescent development. You know, let us not pathologize all parts of the human experience, particularly adolescents, because there are some things that mimic mental health problems, and learning to figure out the difference between a developing mental health problem and what is a normal sort of part of adolescence.
It's often very confusing.
It is. And so it is. And resilience is, you know, drawing on the protective factors that our youth have, and trusted adults in people's lives is one of them. But cultivating all of those other protective factors for youth and really thinking about how resilient we are. And our instructors are very good at this, because, I mean, this is something that's a credential that you walk in with, whether you've had instructor training or not. We've all been adolescents, and we all somehow survived it. We've had the resiliency to become adults that are fairly well adjusted, and we can draw on that and say, what helped us do that? How did we get through what seemed to be, you know, those days that we couldn't see beyond, and crises that we didn't think we were going to live through that somehow we did.
Okay, so to wrap things up, is there something in particular you want folks to take away from this conversation, some take-home points, a couple of just highlights that you want people to stick with people?
I guess I want people to know that that recovery is possible, that every single person is worth our compassion and our respect, and that mental health first aid is one of those things that is really appropriate for anyone. If you're a human being, that course is for you, and we encourage you to take it. Hope to see you in a course.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jill. I appreciate you coming in today.
Thank you.
Please remember you can check out the variety of links and information we have available on today's topic. Just go to alaskapublic.org and click on the link to today's show. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can join us on Facebook. You can find that link on our website, alaskapublic.org. As always, feel free to share your thoughts and comments about today's show with us at our email address. That's line1@alaskapublic.org. On February 20th, local and national experts will be in Anchorage to present the latest and very best information on diabetes at the Taking Control of Your Diabetes Health Conference and Health Fair at the Egan Convention Center. So why not join Dr. Woodard and Dr. John Edelman to discuss the conference and the latest information on controlling these devastating diseases. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron is our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. Thanks for taking the time to join us today on Line One. Till next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.